Good morning. My pleasure indeed to welcome you here to Williamsburg, and I can think of no more noble association to be gathered here once again than that of the Democracy Symposium, U Endeavor, continuing to pursue democracy to its greatest perfection, as I hope we would all recognize the Greeks would have certainly desired, to see what they introduced to mankind to continue to flourish throughout the future of mankind. I welcome you here surely to a seat of democracy. It is but one of the many seats of democracy throughout our civilized world. And I hope indeed that your efforts may be conducive to many more seats to be set throughout this world, and as well to be preserved for the future. I am happy for Senator Gravel's introduction, most ennobled by it, surely. Yes, I did serve 40 years in public service and held many offices. Of course, in this city, I was a member of the House of Burgesses under the old regime. And with our revolution, I was as well a member of the new House of Delegates of Virginia. I was the second elected governor of our new Commonwealth of Virginia. As well, I was appointed ambassador, or as we called it, minister plenipotentiary, to the court of His Majesty King Louis in France. I returned to be appointed as Secretary of State in the administration of President George Washington, and later to become Vice President and finally President. Indeed, I have always considered myself simply a man of the people, that the voice of our citizenry might continue to be heard through those they entrust with their government. Our Constitution indeed continues to change, as you will endeavor. I cannot help but reflect that I did not easily become president any more than it was easy for me to become vice president. When I first stood for the office of president in the campaign of 1796, whoever would receive the second highest number of votes automatically would become president. That was the framing of our Constitution at that time. Can you imagine, as I lost my contest for the office of president against my good friend, Mr. John Adams, I became his vice president. Imagine being vice president with a president you greatly disagree with. I assure you, the next 4 years were not ones of honey and molasses by any means. And by the presidential campaign of 1800, our nation was as greatly divided as the opinions between President Adams and myself. There were not two people standing for the highest office in that campaign of 1800. Rather, there were four. Not only President Adams seeking another term, myself once again to represent the anti-federalist cause, but as well two other gentlemen, General Charles Colesworth Pinckney of South Carolina, a Federalist from the South, and Colonel Aaron Burr, once a Federalist from the new state of New York, and yet, foreseeing a political opportunity, he changed his coat and became an anti-federalist. When the electors went to cast their votes that autumn of 1800, it did not result in an immediate victory. In fact, it resulted in a tie. Not between a Federalist and an Anti-Federalist. No, President Adams was not even in the second highest account of votes. Rather, it was a tie between two Anti-Federalists, Colonel Aaron Burr and Thomas Jefferson. And can you imagine, my fellow Americans, for many, many weeks, the United States of America did not know who would be their next president. Unimaginable, is it not? It was decided to put the election into the House of Representatives beginning in February of 1801, and the representatives voted, and they voted, and they voted 36 times before they broke the tie. Coincidentally, I was informed about the 33rd ballot that Alexander Hamilton despised Aaron Burr more than he did me. And so most of his influence then went into my court. And on the 17th of February, 1801, I was elected the third president. I considered then that the campaign of 1800 did not properly enounce the voice of the people. And yet I stood indeed to represent the second American Revolution. It was, in my opinion, as much a revolution over the principles of our nation as that of 1776 was in its form, but with one great difference. Not one firelock was raised, nor blood was shed in a peaceable transfer of government. And all the ancient kingdoms of Europe, especially our former enemy, Great Britain, stood up and took note. Perhaps the American experiment of self-government might survive. That experiment continues on in your effort to recognize, as I informed Mr. James Madison once I'd learned of the resolutions of the Constitutional Convention, I was not there. That summer of 1787 in Philadelphia, Mr. Madison, continuing to inform me of the progress of the Constitutional Convention, finally wrote me in the late autumn of 1787 that a constitution had indeed been formed. I was captivated by the construction of our constitution and yet greatly concerned. The constitution, in the hands of any government, could be read to its own particular political purpose without attention to the citizenry of our land. And therefore I wrote Mr. Madison that a Bill of Rights is what is necessary for any free people upon this globe, indeed against their own government, to preserve the power of the people to seat their own government. Delighted indeed that my advices, as well supported through the advices finally of Mr. Madison, he was not in favor of it initially, were to end in the resolution of a Bill of Rights, which allows then our Constitution to grow as we grow as a people, to be elastic. Otherwise, as I have said, we might expect a boy of 14 to wear the same coat at the age of 40. Laws and institutions must keep pace with the people. I have written here, if you would allow, a certain opinion upon your efforts in this most historic city, and hope indeed that we recognize that the past is but prologue as you continue your venture to Philadelphia and further, a venture I know well. I welcome you here to Williamsburg, a city with which I have been most familiar for 20 years of my early life, and where I began 40 years in public service. I am most honored to be here in your presence today as you begin as well a most noble public service to further the recognition of the necessity of citizen involvement with their government. It was precisely such involvement over 200 years ago which helped to excite the public interest to no longer tolerate the insidious encroachments of a government determined to ignore the voice of its citizenry. Indeed, it was from this city that there went out a voice to form a Congress in Philadelphia in the autumn of 1774. And it was in this city, that same summer of 74, that my pamphlet, entitled The Summary View of the Rights of British America, was first published, later to be printed throughout the world as testimony that the rights of man are inherent in nature and given to mankind by nature and nature's God, and not by any government or chief magistrate. Indeed, this pamphlet provoked immediate public recognition of the three greatest rights we hold in nature. Rights essential to the freedom of Englishmen, as well essential to the family of man. Firstly, the right to hold an opinion freely and to freely express it. Secondly, the right to freely assemble and to draw the natural diversity of the opinions of mankind into compromise for the public good. And lastly, the right to petition one's government for redress of grievances. How well we knew then that each of these natural rights were being ignored by our government, His Majesty, and indeed His Parliament. And how well did I wish to emphasize in my summary view that if the people themselves remain quiet, inactive, then they succeed only to feed their government power and to fatten their government to become as wolves. How well any people should know that a wolf well fed is the more prepared to bite the hand that has fed it. I did not attend that first Congress held in Philadelphia, but my summary view, also printed in that city, was distributed amongst the delegates of that Congress, and so it was that I became renowned as an author, even in my absence. 2 years later, when I was asked to write the Declaration of American Independence, I endeavored once again to reiterate the natural rights we hold to be self-evident, and that not only are governments instituted among men to secure these rights, deriving their just powers from the consent of the governed, but especially whenever any form of government becomes destructive of these ends, it is the right of the people to alter or abolish it, and to institute new government, laying its foundation on such principles and organizing its powers in such forms as to them shall seem most likely to affect their safety and happiness. Though I consider both my summary view and the Declaration of American Independence to be expressions of the American mind in clear and simple terms so that all may understand it, in its content, the content indeed of the summary view and the Declaration, there is not one new or original thought. Rather, what I have written and what I have continued to espouse in my public service, beginning in this city, is all to be found in the elementary books of public right. Amongst so many, the works of Aristotle, of Cicero, Algernon Sidney, and Mr. John Locke, the works each individual has the freedom to acquire and with which to acquaint themselves. Indeed, we attempt nothing new, but rather continue the work already pursued for so long throughout human history. The history of our past indeed allows us to be judges of our future and to continue the general improvement of the condition of man, laying open to every view the palpable truth that the mass of mankind has not been born with saddles on their back, nor favored few booted and spurred ready to ride them, but rather that the people of every country are the only safe repositories of their own rights, that no government will long survive if it does not recognize it receives its just powers to govern from the governed, and especially that ignorance is not bliss. An educated citizenry will forever be the most safe and well defended, and education will always remain the true corrective for the abuses of any constitutional power. As naturally, these rights are inherent, a trust in the capability of man himself for self-government is necessary. A recognition that no free government can succeed if it does not trust of its citizenry, and as well, especially necessary, that the citizenry recognize their great responsibility for preserving self-government. For indeed, if self-government rests in the responsibility of each citizen to govern themselves, it must be there that self-government is first expressed. How can we govern others if we cannot attend to governing ourselves first? How well the ancient Greeks, who gave the civilized world the concept of democracy, knew the requisite of governing oneself, one's passions, one's ambitions, one's nature, entirely in order to be capable of governing others. Each year they made pilgrimage to the great oracles, foremost amongst them, the Oracle at Delphi, in a quest to know thyself. This quest continues today amongst civilized man and remains continually contested. Today, as so often in our past, we realize freedom is not free. It requires an eternal vigilance. If the people do not stand to utilize their natural rights, they shall most assuredly lose them. No contest in the future of our nation can be more different from the many instances of our past in which we put to test our right of freedom of opinion, the right of assembly, and our right to petition our government for redress of grievances. The outcome of my contest so many years ago, indeed upon the validity of my summary view of the rights of British America and the Declaration of American Independence, I am happy to know has been assured in the approbation of the ages. But that contest for mankind is far from over, as our nation continues to set an example on behalf of the validity of self-government. The future is now in your hands. It is indeed for you to proceed to keep alight a beacon of hope for the rest of the world, to account that each generation does have a right to choose for itself the form of government it believes the most promotive of its happiness, and surely to promote that unless the mass retains sufficient control over those entrusted with the powers of their government, that these will be perverted to their own oppression and to the perpetuation of wealth and power in individuals and their families selected for their trust. I can assure you that I continue on, steering my bark with hope at the bow and fear well astern. I am your servant.